in which the theme of the program is regulations. Can't live with them, can't run an economy without them. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Wednesday, the 22nd day of November. Glad, as always, to have you here, everybody. Regulation number one today, a holdover, really, from our top story yesterday that Ajit Pai, the chairman of the Federal Communications Commission, wants to repeal Obama-era rules on net neutrality. There is going to be a vote in the middle of December. Chairman Pai's motion is going to carry tomorrow's news today, 3-2 along party lines. But before rules like these become final, there is a required public comment period. Sometimes, as Marketplace's Mariel Segarra explains, more for show than anything else.
The federal comments period goes back to FDR. In its early days, his administration set up a ton of new federal agencies.
And they essentially began to regulate the economy at a very detailed level. So everything from how much farmers could charge for milk in the open market to what you could or couldn't do in terms of interstate travel.
Larry Downs, who teaches at Georgetown, says these rules were meant to pull the country out of the Great Depression. But by the time Truman came into office,
we looked back and we said, all right, we now have this massive administrative state. It is sort of like the fourth branch of government.
To counter that, Congress passed the Administrative Procedure Act of 1946. It required federal agencies to accept public comments on any rules they proposed. That's still the law. Thing is, a lot of the comments these agencies get aren't substantive. They're form letters or one-liners that say things like, net neutrality is what we want and need. Philip Napoli at Duke University says federal agencies focus on comments that make an argument.
Comments that actually have detailed quantitative analysis are often given a lot of weight, or detailed legal analysis.
Agencies will tweak their rules based on these kinds of comments. But Susan Dudley, who teaches at George Washington University, says it's rare to see an agency change course entirely.
It's not as if they get the comments and say, oh, I never thought of that before. I'm going to change everything that I've been thinking about.
But at least the agencies can say they're listening. I'm Mariel Segarra for Marketplace.
Interesting item from New York Attorney General Eric Schneiderman along these lines, by the way. Schneiderman says his office has been investigating what appear to be spam public comments sent to the FCC about net neutrality. Comments that are fake, but that use the identities of real people. Comments that were also, Schneiderman says, more favorable to Chairman Pai's position than not. And the FCC, once again, Schneiderman says, has not responded to his requests for assistance in that investigation. All right, regulation number two on this Wednesday, imported washing machines. Specifically, a recommendation from the International Trade Commission that President Trump impose tariffs on said imported washing machines. It sounds, as does much with regulations, bureaucratic and boring. But in reality, also, as with most regulations, there is a whole lot on the line. From Washington, Marketplace's Scott Tong has that one.
The washing machine case brought by Whirlpool just went through its less political stage, known as the International Trade Commission. The ITC is bipartisan, and its job is to ask a straightforward question. Is a U.S. company getting hurt by foreign competition? Laura Balfman is president of the Trade Partnership, a research firm.
They're not looking at unfair pricing or subsidies or anything like that. So the question purely is one about whether or not U.S. producers are being hurt by imports.
Here, the commission found yes, Whirlpool is hurt, and it recommended that the president impose 50% import taxes on large household washing machines, at least when imports exceed $1.2 million per year. That would hurt LG and Samsung, which are gaining in the U.S. market. Now, the final decision goes to the president, who has huge leeway, says Chad Bown at the Peterson Institute for International Economics.
All they're doing here is making a recommendation to the president. Ultimately, President Trump can decide to do whatever it is that he wants. So he could choose to ignore their recommendations entirely.
This type of trade challenge works that way. It's known in the lingo as a Section 201 case. And given this president's protectionist bent, Section 201 could be good to Whirlpool and any other domestic company that follows.
If the president imposes trade barriers in this particular case, we could indeed see a flood of these additional types of cases.
Now, putting up trade walls could limit competition and raise prices, or it could spark a trade war. In Washington, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
Nothing like a good Section 201 story, I always say, huh? Regulation number three today can be boiled down to what in the ever-loving heck were they thinking? The news late yesterday from Uber that not only had it been hacked last year, personal information for 57 million Uber riders and drivers, but also that Uber had paid the hackers $100,000 to delete the data, and also, the New York Times reports, then tracked down those hackers to get them to sign non-disclosure agreements to keep the hack quiet. Interestingly enough, that is not what the regulations say companies are supposed to do when something like this goes down. Marketplace's Aaron Schrank is on it.
Unlike publicly traded companies, private ones like Uber don't need to report breaches to the Securities and Exchange Commission, but there are laws they should be following, says cybersecurity analyst Aviva Leighton at research firm Gartner.
There's no federal disclosure law, but there are something like 48 state disclosure laws,
including California's, Uber's home state. That law requires businesses to disclose data breaches of unencrypted sensitive personal information, quote, in the most expedient time possible and without unreasonable delay.
That leaves a lot of discretion to the company what they are going to, you know, purport to be a reasonable delay.
Greg Pollock at cybersecurity startup UpGuard says the Federal Trade Commission can also punish a company, but there's no standardized fines for breaking data laws. They vary case by case, which means the risks to brand reputation are often seen as much worse than any regulatory penalties.
Companies have an incentive to downplay and obfuscate information when they are breached,
which Pollock says can make future breaches even more likely because companies fail to properly investigate the root cause of the hack. Kim Jones is a cybersecurity professor at Arizona State University. He says a high-profile breach disclosure can really shake up a competitive industry.
If Company A has a breach and Company B doesn't, then consumers may be inclined to migrate to Company B.
In the fallout, Uber has pushed out two executives, including its chief security officer, and the company is facing an investigation by New York's attorney general. I'm Aaron Schrank for Marketplace.
Motions going through them. That's what traders were doing on Wall Street. Today we'll have the details when we do the numbers. Insurance is never exactly a fun thing to talk about, but coming out of the last couple of months of severe weather and wildfires, insurance does seem to be an important thing to talk about. Tom Wilson is the CEO of Allstate, they of the You're in Good Hands insurance. We called him up in Allstate's home city, Chicago, for the latest installment of Conversations from the Corner Office. Mr. Wilson, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
All right, let me throw a couple of phrases at you, get your gut-level reaction. The first one, obviously, given this season, has to be hurricanes.
Well, there's a lot more damage than hurricanes. So there's straight-line winds, there's wildfires, as you know, up in Napa. There's hail. So these disasters happen continuously all throughout the year. We spend over several billion dollars a year helping people rebuild. And so it's all about the severe weather, and the weather is worse.
All right. Well, let me deviate then from my throwing a couple of things at you and dig into that one a little bit. You know, you're the guy or one of several guys and people who pays for our rebuilding in areas where we know bad things are going to happen. Right. They're going to rebuild on mountainous areas and we're going to have fires there. We're going to rebuild on beaches and we know we're going to have floods and hurricanes there. Are we doing it wrong?
There's two parts to that. So first, there's the private
yes
market.
Yes and no.
Right?
No,
yeah. So in the private market, it works pretty well. I believe that the governments are not doing it well, particularly the federal government. So as you point out, you know, people have floods, same house floods three times in a row. People rebuild it three times in a row. And we're using taxpayers' money to redo that. Really, the federal government needs to think about this more holistically rather than just get in and when bad things happen, start helicoptering in and throwing all kinds of money out at people because it's politically expedient.
Well, so let's take Houston just for an example, where I know you probably lost a whole bunch of money in the flooding after Hurricane Harvey. Should the government be saying to people, you know what, you cannot build in that what is now a dried out reservoir, but when the rains come, you're going to be underwater?
Well, I think you can't do it immediately, right? Because people built there and they built there under the rules that existed at the time. I think what the federal government could do is say, over time, we're going to move to a different system. So if you're supposed to pay $500 for insurance and today you're paying $100, over the next 3 or 4 years, we're going to get you up to $500. If you shouldn't be there at all, then we're not going to let you rebuild. So we really need a multi-year plan to get ourselves out from where we've built stuff which's in harm's way.
Let me turn the page here for a second to sort of a second gig that you have. You are the chairman of the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. We've had those folks on a couple of times in the last couple of months talking about some of the policy changes that are going on in Washington. I wonder how you see the chamber's role in the Trump administration's economic policies and where the chamber stands on that, because the folks we've talked to have not always been in favor of what's going on.
Well, maybe back up a little bit. So first, I believe that the U.S. Chamber is there to help business do what it does best, which is create prosperity. So, you know, we take iron rocks and we make steel skyscrapers. We take some molecules, a little chemistry, and some brain power and make life-saving drugs. That's what business does. Governments can't do that. Nonprofits can't do that. Sometimes it's aligned with what the government wants to do. Sometimes it's not aligned with what the government wants to do. So, for example, today on free trade, basically the chamber is keeping the whole NAFTA thing alive by working with Canada, Mexico, and the U.S. to try to move that to some answer. The chamber's in favor of other policies that the government is putting first. So it depends whether it aligns with our ability to help businesses do what they do best.
As a guy running Allstate and also as the guy representing the chamber, how much are you banking on tax reform just in terms of economic growth in this economy and also for your own business?
Well, we think the taxes should be reformed. It's almost like built-up wax on a table. You remember that lemon pledge? there's just been too much wax built up, and so we got to clean it up. We need to make it more competitive internationally, in part because I think people just game the system today. They move locus of profits around the world to try to pay less tax, and we need to change that. We do think lower taxes will drive growth. But I don't think that's the end. I think that's chapter one. Chapter two has to be, how do we do that and not burden our children with increased amounts of debts, which chapter three means, how do we make sure that people get what they need, but that the entitlements don't run out of control?
Well, let me add a chapter four. How do you give corporations tax cuts, which you say corporations need to grow this economy, without burdening average middle class taxpayers, which is what it seems this tax bill does?
This tax bill doesn't actually raise taxes for middle-income people. What it may do is create an increased deficit for the government. Then you get into, well, will it drive enough growth? I believe that, you know, no tax bill is going to solve all of our problems. We still need to go back and figure out, how do we balance a budget, or at least not run as large a deficit as we will do. So there's more work to be done, but you got to do one thing at a time. You know, Washington is having a hard time getting one thing done, much less a comprehensive program that deals with all the things we got going.
Tom Wilson, the CEO of Allstate. Mr. Wilson, thanks a lot for your time, sir.
Thank you, Kai.
We've put the entire conversation Tom Wilson and I had on our Corner Office podcast, including an insurance question that may plague all of us in the not-so-distant future. If your self-driving car hits somebody else's self-driving car, whose insurance is on the hook? Tom's got an answer. It's on our Corner Office podcast. Coming up.
Everybody kind of knows that there's this secret world, this underground river of money, but no one really gets to see it.
Until now, we take a peek at the Panama Papers. But first, let's do the numbers. All right, here you go. On the Wednesday before Thanksgiving, the Dow Industrials off 64 points, 0.2%, finished at 23,526. NASDAQ up 4 points, a bit less than 0.1%, 68.67. The S&P 500 basically flat, 25.97. Last trading day before the doors open for Black Friday holiday spending. Once the rulers of Christmas with its wish book catalog, Sears is on its knees today. It'll cut prices up to 50% at all stores for Black Friday. Shares declined 2.3%. JCPenney climbed about 0.6% today. Macy's unwrapped 1% in gains. That deal over chipmaker Qualcomm is still on the table. Shares rose 0.2% today on reports that the potential buyer Broadcom might sweeten its offer to buy the company. Broadcom shares down about 0.4%. Bond prices rose. Yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 2.32%. New York Stock Exchange et al. Closed tomorrow, obviously half day on Friday. You're listening to Marketplace.
Behind every successful business is a story, and some of them might surprise you. Like how Chobani's first yogurt factory was discovered on a piece of junk mail. Or how the founder of the multi-million dollar cosmetics brand Drunk Elephant was told by everyone, including her own mother, that the name sounded like a dive bar. On the podcast How I Built This, host Guy Raz talks to founders behind the world's biggest companies to learn how they built them. In each episode, you'll hear entrepreneurs share moments of doubt, failure, and how they were able to overcome setbacks on their way to the top. How I Built This is like a masterclass in innovation and creativity, a how-to guide for navigating life's challenges from the people who've done it all. Follow How I Built This wherever you get your podcasts. Listen early and ad-free right now on Wondery Plus. For more business content like this, listen on Wondery, the destination for business podcasts. With shows like How I Built This, Business Wars, and many more, Wondery means business.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Ryssdal. As we wait for the next name to drop in the growing list of high-profile sexual offenders in the workplace, a term, by the way, that sounds far too benign, there is another part of this story that has to be told. The real and justified reluctance among some of the victims to say anything about it at all to human resources. Marketplace's Sabri Benishore takes a look at why that is and how companies might change it.
Part of what makes reporting harassment so hard is the sheer pit-of-your-stomach awfulness of it.
My direct supervisor, we went to a team happy hour. You know, I thought we were just sort of having fun and, you know, as a young, fun guy. At some point, he kissed me.
We're not identifying this woman because she's still employed in the customer service department of the Fortune 500 company where this all happened, and the guy in question is still her boss.
I thought, you know, he had a lot to drink and it was one of those things we'll laugh about hopefully later.
The problem persisted. Her supervisor's advances only ramped up.
I got a lot of pressure to date him basically after that. He wouldn't drop it.
After repeatedly declining her supervisor's advances, things changed for the worse.
The anger came out at work. I got yelled at a lot. He would snap at me all the time. I was walking on eggshells and leaving crying and just a complete wreck.
She thought about going to HR, but didn't.
HR is there to protect the company, not to protect you.
And she wondered, what would it be like afterward if she did report it?
His desk is right next to mine. Like, am I going to be in a 2-month-long investigation having to work right next to this person?
This is pretty much exactly what runs through the minds of most people who've been sexually harassed.
We know that it's pretty rare that women will actually file complaints.
Vicky Magley is a professor of psychology at the University of Connecticut. She's done research on sexual harassment training and prevention. There's the fear of retaliation, the mistrust of HR, and there's also the fear of what exactly will happen.
It's not very clear.
It's not very clear because organizations don't typically talk about what happens when there are complaints.
We have to be confidential all the time.
Susan Lamott is CEO of Exaquio, a brand and workforce consultancy. She's worked in HR for more than 20 years.
It puts HR in a real rock and a hard place to demonstrate that they can be fair, impartial, and support employees.
But Lamott says companies can find ways around that if they actually want to prove to their employees that their HR departments can be trusted.
You can certainly say, this is the number of cases or reports that we've had this year. This is how we are managing them. This is how we're responding to them.
Employees pick up on the slightest of cues when they're trying to figure out, can I trust HR, says the University of Connecticut's Vicky Magley. For example, is sexual harassment training taken seriously by everyone?
It doesn't take much to glance around the room and see, are there higher authority people from your organization in this training session in which you're sitting?
And when there are crises in the public eye, as there are now, do organizations talk to their employees about it? Do they make it crystal clear, for example, that employees will be protected from retaliation should they file a claim? Exaquio's Susan Lamott.
As the CEO or as the chairman of the board, be really clear to say, if things like this happen in our organization, we will take swift, decisive action.
But talking about accountability doesn't make any difference if HR is toothless or undervalued in an organization. In fast-growing startups, for example, it can be the last branch of the company to be staffed, and its managers the least senior. Lauren Edelman teaches law and sociology at Berkeley Law. She recommends a more hardline approach to preventing harassment and demonstrating commitment.
If leaders were accountable and their own promotion up the corporate ladder depended on ensuring a lack of harassment, we might see less harassment.
Another strategy, she says, is having an extra layer or resource before someone ever gets to the point of filing a complaint with HR.
Victim advocates who would help people through the process.
Someone to role play with the victim to get the behavior to stop or to walk them through what happens when you go to HR. That kind of support is not common in the workforce and wasn't available to the woman at the Fortune 500 company. She's looking for a new job. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishor for Marketplace.
We've gotten a good look the past couple of years at how the rich really are different, specifically in how and where they manage and keep their money. First in the Panama Papers, then more recently in the Paradise Papers, the curtain was pulled back on the world of secret offshore accounts and who has them. Jake Bernstein was a senior reporter at the International Consortium of Investigative Journalists when they broke the Panama Papers story. It's an investigation he recounts in his latest book. It's called Secrecy World. Jake, thanks for coming on.
Oh, it's a pleasure. Thank you.
I know it's only been a couple of years, but would you remind us what the Panama Papers were?
Absolutely. The Panama Papers was a massive leak, more than 11.5 million documents coming from a Panamanian law firm called Mossack Fonseca. And the leak showed all kinds of extraordinary things. There were a number of political leaders, including the Prime Minister of Iceland. There were lots of very wealthy people and really 40 years of information on how the offshore world works.
And you, as a senior reporter at ICIJ, had the time and the, I guess, resources to dig into these things. First of all, were you surprised at the scale of the, I don't want to say malfeasance, I don't want to say wrongdoing, but of the enterprises, I guess, that were engaged?
I was. I mean, everybody kind of knows that there's this secret world, this underground river of money, but no one really gets to see it. So we don't know how it functions or really, you know, how it works and who it involves. And so to really see that, to be able to see who's involved and how it touches everything, you know, from property in New York to political leaders in Pakistan was truly extraordinary.
Well, you know, it's interesting. You said nobody gets to see how it functions. It turns out it functions really, really well.
Exceptionally well. I mean, there's trillions of dollars that go through this thing every year. It's extraordinary.
What then is the takeaway from the Panama Papers, also more recently the Paradise Papers, a different law firm, different clientele, if you will, but sort of the same subterranean river of money. It's there. We all know it's there. And yet it continues.
I mean, the takeaway, I think, is the desperate need for more transparency. You know, we have to have a better sense of what's going on in these tax havens, secret bank accounts. There needs to be more information exchanges between different governments. What the Paradise Papers, the latest leak really showed, is that a lot of this behavior is completely legal. Nonetheless, it is very detrimental to society.
We have to say here, though, that President Obama, when the Panama Papers came out, I don't know that he promised, but he certainly said he would crack down on offshoring, and he didn't do any of that.
He didn't do much, that's for sure. The U.S. Treasury Department sat on a rule affecting anonymous bank accounts. They sat on that for several years, and what they came out with at the end of the day was this very watered-down rule. And the reason is that there's a huge number of vested interests that don't want the status quo changed. You know, these are lawyers, these are secretaries of state, these are people who are benefiting from the system.
And also, and this is going to get me some letters, emails, and mean tweets, there are arguably more pressing priorities governmentally.
I mean, pick your priority. This one touches everything. They say that as much as $70 billion a year in tax revenue is shifted from corporate profits to tax havens in the United States every year. So that's a lot of money that could go for healthcare, could go for infrastructure. This, in some ways, does really touch everything.
Jake Bernstein, he covered the Panama Papers for the ICIJ. His book about the whole thing is called Secrecy World. Jake, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Final note on the way out today, another regulatory story, really, one in which tomorrow's principal condiment features prominently. Bloomberg reports there's such a glut in the cranberry market that growers have applied for government permission to turn their excess berries, as much as 15% of the entire U.S. crop, into fertilizer as a way to keep prices up. This will not come as a surprise, I imagine, but 20% of all the cranberries sold every year are sold Thanksgiving week. All right, that's all we got. The Dow off 64 points today, about 0.2%. NASDAQ up 4, less than 0.1%. S&P 500 basically flat. Sarah Bruguer, Jake Gorski, Drew Jostat, Jeff Peters, Dan Powell, Daniel Ramirez, Charlton Thorpe, and Ben Tolliday engineer the broadcast for us. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. Molly's in. I'm out. I got the day off. Bye. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.